Hello there, this is Mark Bauerlein for another conversation. Today we have Mr. Reno, R.R. Reno.
Who is
thank
that
you.
Guy anyway?
the editor-in-chief here of First Things is to join us. And we did not cover a book that Rusty did in 2016, The Resurrecting the Idea of a Christian Society. And I think we should come back to that. The book came out with Renyery, and it was, well, Rusty, obviously the title echoes T.S. Eliot, right?
Yes, it was Eliot in, I think it was 1939, March of 1939, gave some lectures at Cambridge. And he was asked to give them because, of course, people knew that Europe was facing this coming crisis. And Eliot argued that you can't have a neutral society. You either have a society that's organized around a Christian view of human destiny, or you have a pagan society, as he put it. And then he laid out what he took to be the principles or the characteristics of a Christian society. Now, if you've ever read the Eliot's those lectures?
Read sections long ago in graduate school.
They're very dry, actually, yeah. And it's kind of he drew his title from Samuel Taylor Coleridge on the Constitution of Church and State. So idea here means not any actual society, but rather kind of what would the social form and its ideal form, what are the elements of it? And so with Eliot-esque abstraction, he pursues that question. And I wanted to come at it much more grounded in the realities of 21st century United States.
You actually title the first chapter here, The Need for a Christian Society, as if you're writing out of, Eliot had his moment.
Yes.
Of your crisis in Europe. What did you sense in, I mean, the book comes out in 2016, you're writing it mostly in 2015. Did you sense some sort of cultural fracture or crisis underway?
Oh, crisis is one of those overused, yeah, but yeah, kind of unavoidable words right now. The crisis of the 1930s was a kind of consolidation of people, a kind of upsurge of nationalism, and the totalitarian threat. I think we're in some ways 180 degrees removed from that. We're exactly the opposite. So instead of a society that's overly compact, overly consolidated, we live in a society that's coming apart, to use that Charles Murray's book that was very influential to me when I read it in 2012. And so our crisis is really one that, you know, our society's kind of falling apart. It's demoralized in both a metaphorical sense and really in quite a literal sense. So we have, you know, we have a decline in life expectancy, which is, that's like blood pressure. Or, you know, the blood pressure is spiking. It's a, you know, any doctor would freak out with vital signs that go negative like that. Mm-hmm. I think it's an indication that our society is becoming increasingly dysfunctional. And that's driving the political uproar in 2016, the election of Trump. People were rejecting the leaders that were being offered to them by the establishment. Why is that? It's because our society it doesn't seem to be working well for most people.
Just this is a side comment, but from what you just said, do you take Donald Trump's Christianity seriously?
No.
No. Is it a fake?
Not that either.
No. More kind of an instinctive draw toward.
I would never look to Donald Trump for theological or spiritual guidance, but nevertheless, I think as I indicate in the book, the penultimate chapter is titled "Seeking Higher Things." So I organized the book you know, defend the weak, raise up the poor, promote solidarity, limit government, and seek higher things. I call them the kind of underlying Christian or biblical values that I think our society needs to recover. And so when I look at Trump and his religious rhetoric as this intuitive recognition that public life, and really in our lives as individuals, have to be oriented to something greater. And, you know, as is the case in so many other aspects of his leadership, he's not terribly articulate about that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, well, it would be great if he could be more articulate, but it's better to have people gesturing towards some transcendent horizon for our collective life together as Americans. That's much better, however inarticulate it is, than no reference to that at all.
I find that those followers of Donald Trump take much more from him than just the promises of prosperity, the promises of jobs. Of course, you know, those are fundamental, but it's a lot more than that.
Yeah, if we look at that promote solidarity chapter, you know, one of the buzzwords we have in our time, diversity. And people will say, I really like my neighborhood because it's diverse. What they're really saying, it seems to me, because diversity is it's a kind of a meaningless world. Diversity with respect to what? What they're really saying is they want to live in a society where they share a common life with their fellow citizens. And of course, you can't share something unless you're with them in some sense, shoulder to shoulder. And I think part of what Trump's appeal to many people is they feel like we've lost a sense of what we share as Americans. And one of the perversions of identity politics is that it accentuates what divides us and it doesn't draw attention to the common loves that we share. And so, you know, Donald Trump's Make America Great Again, his patriotic gestures, I think people find this to be inspiring. So you're right. I don't think people just want jobs. They also want to be part of something greater than themselves.
Now, back to the book, when people see a title like Resurrecting the Idea of a Christian Society, the word, you know, theocon, right, pops into their heads. Theocracy, you are instituting once again the rule.
You're absolutely correct about people's response, Mark.
That's just immediate.
Probably an ill-chosen title on my part.
Or maybe, hey, let's get the issue right up front in order for me to show.
But like
that
I always tell people, it's the idea of a Christian society. So
well, but
right, or maybe I should have said it should be resurrecting the ideals of a Christian society, because ultimately the book is not an argument that clerics should make laws.
Right.
It's an argument that we should have good laws, we should have laws that promote human flourishing, and that the biblical horizon is a reliable guide on what is necessary for human flourishing. And so that's really what the book's arguing.
And that there is more freedom in a Christian society than in a pagan or a secular society?
A secular society is a pagan society.
Yes.
In this sense.
Yes.
You know, we're not worshiping Zeus or, you know, we're not, or Moloch or something like that. But we do. Our lives are governed by what I call the hearth gods of health, wealth, and pleasure. And so, sort of one of the features of contemporary life is the rise of the people with no religious affiliation, the so-called nuns. And, you know, New York is full of nuns, N-O-N-E-S. And, you know, they wake up in the morning, they go to the gym, and they worship the god of health. And then they go to work, and they spend 12 hours at work in their professional jobs, pursuing worshiping the god of wealth. And then they head out to the wine bar in the evening and buy locally sourced food or what have you, and they worship the hearth god of pleasure. And so we're very much in the grip of what St. Paul called the principalities and powers that rule this world.
Yeah.
And I think a secular society, the danger is that it abandons us to, there's no counter love, there's no counter authority to the authority of these worldly powers. And so it's not the case that we live independently. In fact, we wind up being abandoned to a kind of enslavement to these worldly powers.
And if you ask people, from what I've seen, people do not feel more free now. They do not feel more, I mean, the happiness measures are down.
Yeah, I mean, right. And so if we think of, I mean, I start out, you know, I really tackle this question of freedom. I call it the American dream. The American dream is not to get wealthy, although that can be an element of it, but it's the main dream is a dream of freedom, and that is we can make the future that the conditions into which we are born do not determine our future. Our destiny is ours to make. It's the self-made man idea, and it has an economic dimension to it. But I remember I was working on the book talking to you about this. You know, Ralph Waldo Emerson, the cowboy, what have you. You gave me that great line that J.P. Morgan in his walnut paneled office is not the American hero. It's the John Wayne character. And why is the John Wayne character the hero? Because he lives by his own lights, not in accord with, you know, the conventions of this world, or not in accord with the dictates of the boss. So that's the kind of vision of freedom that I think is noble, the idea of being able to make your own destiny.
Yes.
To be self-governing.
Right.
That I live in accord with my own sense of who I am and what are my ultimate convictions and ultimate goals and aspirations. I think that's actually a correct definition of freedom. But how can you actually do that? And the liberal project in the United States mostly emphasizes on removing the impediments,
right,
and then empowering you. But its notion of empowerment is it doesn't actually succeed in empowering because it doesn't actually give you anything to be loyal to. Because the Christian view of freedom is that we're free. We're freer insofar, as St. Paul says, for freedom Christ has set us free. And so we're the only way to be free from worldly powers, free from the power of sin, is to give yourself over to a higher and more powerful truth. And it's our loyalty to that truth that allows us to stand strong and live in accord with the things we actually believe.
Right. When people recite diversity, it's like you said, well, for what? Diversity for diversity? What actually, I mean, you said it's people want to have a common life with all the people of them who make up America in some fashion. But, you know, let's get concrete here. That's not what diversity produces. Look at college campuses, which are so devoted to diversity. So they're some of the most coercive, intellectually coercive places now on Earth. I mean, everyone on campus is nervous these days.
Well, but that goes back to if you say, well, everybody, freedom is being able to be self-governing. Well, that means we have to eliminate or at least weaken the demands or claims that are put on people. That's the liberal view. And so diversity is a kind of therapy of weakening. So, you know, instead of there being some normal or authoritative way, you say, oh no, there are many ways. And so the relativism is a kind of therapy of weakening. So most people who are relativists, they're not really relativists. What they do is they want to say, well, we have to be non-judgmental. And to be non-judgmental, to give everybody space to live the life that they want to live, we have to adopt a kind of view that this is meaningful to me, it's true for me, but not true for you. And so that's kind of the dominant view, and then political correctness just simply enforces that and makes that obligatory.
And their sense of a Christian society is a form of judgmentalism. Right?
And it is, and I think that, and it is judgmental, but I guess I argue in the book that That really is the only way that you can preserve a culture of freedom, is you have to offer people things that are worthy of their love and loyalty. You know, parents, they make great sacrifices for their children, and that is an act of freedom, to be free from your own selfishness, or free from the passing whims of your desires that change all the time. And then this is the sense about communal solidarity or civic solidarity. You know, people make sacrifices and they stand strong together for some common purpose. And that's what people cherish about nationalism or cherish about patriotism. They cherish it because it actually empowers them, and by empowering them makes them free. Because, you know, don't tread on me, great American idea. Well, you know, you think about it, one of the reasons we focus so much on sex is because it's something that you can be completely enslaved to our economic system, completely enslaved as a young person to the meritocratic scramble through test taking and, you know, networking and all that kind of stuff. But at least in the area of sex, you're not being, you know, you can do what you want. Mm-hmm. It's a kind of compensatory freedom, but not a genuine freedom.
Why is it, though, that people who insist on not judging, being non-judgmental, are some of the most humorless, you know, restrained, uptight? They're so worried that you're going to judge, and they're going to stop you from judging.
Well, because they have this view of freedom, right? Freedom is letting people make up. It's a John Stuart Mill, Experiments in Living. He recognized that the cultural norms are a far greater threat to this ability to experiment in life than any government could possibly be. So the non-judgmentalism, the enforced political correctness, the tut-tut-tutting, you know, you're not allowed to make any strong moral statement, is a kind of policing to create this neutral zone. But again, I just keep pointing in the book back to the actual fruits of this. We've been embarked on this experiment now for 50 plus years, and the results have been a upper class enslaved to the mad meritocratic scramble to success. I mean, my grandfather, who was a very successful man, he would be shocked at the kind of puritanical, ascetic self-denial that people in their 30s and 40s in the United States. I mean, nobody smokes. Everybody exercises. I don't think my grandfather exercised, you know, probably a single day after he came back from World War II. I think he didn't like to go camping. He said he slept on the ground often enough. And whereas we embrace all this asceticism of exercise and self-care and all that sort of thing. On the bottom half of society, or even increasingly more, we have people, as I said, you know, increasing deaths of despair. You know, if this is freedom, well, it doesn't look like freedom to me.
Well, this was the argument that liberalism offered. Here's how you put it. The message is clear. There is no firm higher truth about how to live, because that leads us into, you know,
judgmentalism. Yeah, right.
But the resulting meaninglessness, as Epicurus and Lucretius consolingly tell us, is a life-affirming message. For if nothing is worth sacrificing for, then nobody will need to make sacrifices. Instead of straining to fit ourselves into cultural and moral molds, we can just get on with life. We no longer need to live for the sake of higher truths. We can now live for the sake of life. That's like, why do we have diversity? For diversity.
Right.
These big high ideals, they make people unhappy.
Right. They become coercive, dangerously alluring, creating fanaticism. And there's some truth to that intuition. You know, this is always the peril. There is no safe way in public life. I mean, those of us who have responsibilities for leadership in our communities or in the broader public, there is no formula by which you can avoid the perversions and dangers. And in a society that is organized around higher things, as I call them, the danger is fanaticism. It can be a kind of Pharisaic mentality. There's all kinds of perversions, a kind of harrying, hectoring Puritanism. Those are all dangers. But the danger of a society that refuses to offer normative truths, you know, authoritative vision of human flourishing, the danger of that society is lassitude, a kind of enervating skepticism, and then a kind of aimlessness of life, all of which I think lead you to just a default slavery to the marketplace and the intense, relentless competition for status on social media.
How does multiculturalism fit into sort of the non-judgmental or the more relativistic approach? Is that kind of you take non-judgmentalism into a diversity situation? Multiculturalism is is a managerial?
No, I think non-judgmentalism, I think of as a kind of personal, you know, you train young people to be non-judgmental. And I think of multiculturalism as a kind of cultural affirmative action policy. I mean, if you want to empower the marginalized, then you need to reduce the power of the center and redistribute cultural power away from the center and towards the peripheries. And so that's why multiculturalism has always, critics say, well, they're inconsistent. You know, every culture except Western culture, right? I mean, I'm sure you've heard that critique many, many times.
Yes.
But it fails to understand what multiculturalism is trying to achieve. It's trying to achieve a society where there is no center, there is no privileged center. And to do that, you have to affirm, you know, classes on Islam, classes about Chinese culture, classes about Native America, everything except the dominant culture of the West. Like I said, it's a kind of cultural affirmative action. You have to take affirmative action to privileged marginal voices in order to weaken the authority, the coercive authority of the center. All towards the end of freedom, I would argue.
Your ultimate point is that when we look at this at this moment, that multiculturalism, political correctness, secularization has produced something of a vacuum, and that there is an opportunity now, and here's how you put it, which is why in this time and in this place, a relatively small number of Christians can inspire and reinvigorate the public imaginations of the disoriented majority. We can renew our society by restoring our voices as Christian citizens.
I look and I see talented, successful young people completely in the thrall of this ruthless meritocratic machine. I look at people in Youngstown, Ohio, or rural America in the thrall of their own vices, alcoholism, drug addiction, can't maintain stable families. And in that context, Christians who are serving a higher truth than either their passing whim to find pleasure or to the mad scramble for success and celebrity, I think it's inspiring to people. They want to live like that because that is true freedom. That's the ability to live, to be able to say no. Nietzsche said that the first word of freedom is no, not yes, because we come into a world that's from the very beginning is trying to take possession of us and command us and compel us, get it to do our bidding. Advertisers are trying to get us to do our bidding. Employers are trying to get us to do their bidding. And we have to be able to say no in order to take the first step towards saying yes to what we truly care about. And the ability to say no has to come from our loyalty to a higher power. Sounds like Alcoholics Anonymous, doesn't it? I guess there's a kernel of truth in AA.
When one comes into the public square as an openly Christian voice, I mean, foregrounding one's biblical, one's Christian orientation to things, Certainly, the elite voices respond with skepticism and worse, but you believe that you get outside that 20% world of the culture, the media and the journalists and so on, people respond to that. They feel it. And I saw, I was at an event, we were doing a panel, we were doing an event in Texas, and there were several hundred people in the audience, a lot of students, their high school students, and one man gave up, it was on technology and youth, and he was talking about, he was a doctor, but he was talking about his experiences becoming an addict to games, video games, and these multiplayer games, and he said, I would go hours and hours a day after work. I could not stop, but he prefaced his story by dedicating everything he was going to say afterward to Jesus Christ. And I could sense maybe some people in the room were thinking, oh boy, you know, some eye roll. But the vast majority of the crowd was impressed. They said, this is a person of moral seriousness. This is a person who is speaking out of a depth of belief and faith that really set the stage for what he said afterwards.
God ups the ante. And as soon as you state that what you're going to say and do, you put sort of before God for judgment, you are upping the ante. And even people who don't believe in God know that you're doing that. They may say, well, God doesn't exist, but hey, for this guy at least, he's being serious because he's exposing himself to God's judgment.
Well,
which is what the guy said when he said, I'm going to dedicate it to Jesus Christ. What he's really saying is that, and may I be judged if I bear false testimony, if I trim, if I lie, if I distort, if I say what is pleasing. And so it's why would even people who are skeptical and non-believers are willing to take oaths on a Bible, in a court of law or these sorts of things, because again, it's an atmosphere or it's a gesture of, you know, raising what is being said to a more serious plane. And my experience in public fora is that the Bible, words of the Bible, have power. I mean, Abraham Lincoln, and it wasn't just that we were a more religious nation, it's not even clear we were a more religious nation in 1864 when he gave the second inaugural address. I guess that was, what, March of 1865, actually, when he gave the second inaugural address, that which is one of the great works of public theology, rich in biblical phraseology and explicit biblical quotation. But the Bible has power. It's a direct, earthy, and also at the same time transcendent. And I would urge listeners not to be shy about appealing to the Bible. It's you don't have to believe that the Bible is the Word of God to find the second chapter of Genesis a powerful expression about the meaning of marriage, the nature of marriage.
One thing I think that readers of the book will come away believing is, and I think this is an important lesson for them to take, is that your reverence can easily overcome the easy irreverence that is so common in our world today.
You know, as you said, it's an easy irreverence.
It's the easy irreverence, the easy irony, the jaded outlook. When you have someone standing there who does what you said, who is saying, I'm putting myself on the line with God here. I'm not judging you here. I'm the one who is going to be judged when I do this. I think that overcomes the Bill Maher irreverence just like that for all the people in the real, you know, the thoughtful people in the audience.
Yeah, that's the moment we're in. When we were young and in college, the irreverence still had a kind of potency.
Right.
But we're a long way from that time now. Now, skepticism and doubt and irony and critical distance are it's the default setting. And someone who could stand up and say, no, this is true.
And you put it, but America is demoralized right now. People don't want to be demoralized. Demoralization is not a nice condition to be in. It doesn't feel good to be demoralized. When you take strength from a moralizing figure. And I think the turn is there. The non-judgmentalism. One thing I think political correctness is a profoundly moral demand.
Yes.
That people, it's not relativistic in that sense. It comes out of a moral impulse. It's a bad expression of a moral impulse.
Also, I think fighting global warming. Yes. That's another. So you see, young people are just desperate for a noble cause to ally themselves with.
Right.
And I think something heroic. And I think we're at a time now. It's what 21st century. I believe that, we're facing, it is a crisis, and if we as Christians don't give our fellow citizens noble causes that arise out of deep truths about the human person and the truths of Revelation, then they'll wind up serving heroic causes that are ignoble.
Yeah, and we don't deserve their devotion if we don't. Okay. Thank you, Rusty. The book again, Resurrecting the Idea of a Christian Society with Renyery.
Very good. Well, thanks, Mark.